What's up, bosses? Before we kick off this episode, I want to tell you about our sponsor this week. It is Indeed.com. These are our hiring goals, they say. They're very aggressive. But when everyone looks at you, you're calm. Why is that? Because you know you don't need a miracle. You need Indeed. Indeed is the hiring platform where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. So instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed is a powerful hiring partner that can help you do it all. They have all kinds of great time-saving tools to help you find amazing talent, like Indeed's instant match assessments and virtual interviews. I'm going to tell you all about those features coming up in the break in the show. But if you want to get a jump start on hiring right now, we're going to hook you up with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post when you head over to Indeed.com/iLab. This offer is only good for a limited time, so claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/ILAB. One more time, that's Indeed.com/iLab. Terms and conditions apply. Pay per qualified applicant, not available for all users. Need to hire? You need Indeed. All right, let's kick off this episode of Invest Like a Boss.
Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
What's up, bosses? Episode 232 of the Invest Like a Boss podcast. I got Sam on the other end. My name is Derek, and Sam's looking a little sleepy. We're trying to do video this time because I think we can interact a little better when we can actually see each other, and I can possibly trust my internet this week, but we'll see how it goes. Sam, wake up. What are you doing?
What am I doing? I just finished 6 hours of corporate calls. Welcome to the new Sam Marks. Employee number 6,240 for a pretty large organization. I am sleepy, Derek. Thank you. But you just woke me
up. So excited about this new venture, Sam.
and I think I just had COVID. I'm getting over COVID. You might hear a little crackle in my voice. So yeah, it's been one of those last few days.
Dude, COVID is going around, but it's weird because I think we've just accepted the fact that we're going to get it and we'll get through it. But it's like so different from like 2 years ago where you're like, oh my God, if I get COVID, like I could be in real problems. Now it's just like, we're going to have it and it's going to happen.
We're going to have it. We're going to give it to all my friends. We're going to give it to my family.
Yeah.
We're going to get it back in two months from now again.
I know, it's wild. Well, we're trying out some new things. The last few weeks, the podcast has been a little bit different. You might've noticed. We're trying out some new experimental kind of stuff. And we thought that we'd kind of revisit this interview that Sam did with Justin Donald. Justin was actually a guest on iLab back in November of 2021. It was episode 204, if you want to go back and check that out. We learned Justin's story. He's got a lot of cool stuff. I think he got rich doing trailer parks. I think that was kind of the first one. He did Cutco.
Little parks.
Yeah. Cutco, yeah. Cutlery.
Cutco. Yep. Yep.
Really cool guy. Killing it now. Got it. Wild, like mastermind group that's like 30 grand a year, I think. But everyone, at least Sam, that you know that's in it, has said it's 100% worth the fee.
Yeah. And Justin actually just wrote me recently. He's heading over to guess where? Bordeaux for some exclusive wine tastings, and then to Cannes, I think, for the Films Festival. And then over to Portugal to start his Golden Visa application. So he's got all types of cool stuff going on.
I think he said he's also going to the F1 race in Monaco too. It's like, you know, while you're over there, might as well just hit up the trifecta of awesomeness.
Make sure you put on Instagram and make me jealous no matter where I am.
Right. So Justin's a cool guy. You and him had a lot of stuff in common. So I think it was great that you actually hopped on his podcast. He has a podcast called the Lifestyle Investor Podcast. And we're thinking the chances are most of you guys probably didn't hear that interview. So it'd be a good chance to kind of air that interview. And it's a really good backstory on Sam and how he got to the point where, you know, he built up a business kind of starting in college where you had one plan and then it, like, due to things that happened in college, things changed and you went abroad and then you built this huge business and a huge exit. So we've always touched on little bits and pieces of that, but I think this is a good comprehensive view of the story of Sam.
Yeah. So if you go back to episode one of Invest Like a Boss, that's kind of, I'd say that's probably about 3 years post exit. And we talked a little bit about there, but it was really more about, hey, we're here now. And it was with Johnny at, on that first episode. And it was like, we're here now. We both don't know what we're doing, how to invest, like, let's go on this journey. And that's kind of where it started off. But we never really touched deep on the backstory on my success at SkySig and how I kind of got to that point. And we did one with Johnny that was a really popular episode called How to 300X Your Return. That was one of our first, I think, 20 episodes, and people loved that episode. So we thought this would be kind of a comparable or a similar episode. So this is a replay from Justin Donald's interview with me on his podcast, The Lifestyle Investor.
Yeah, let's check it out. So we go all the way from Sam in college to Sam today. It's a really cool look at everything. It's Justin Donald, Lifestyle Investor podcast. Let's check out the interview.
Well, Sam, I'm so excited to get a chance to hang out with you. This has been a long time coming because we've got a mutual friend in Brian Rabbit, who's part of our mastermind, Lifestyle Investor Mastermind. And he's like, you guys just have to connect. You'll be two peas in a pod. And he couldn't have been more correct. I have just had so much fun getting to know you, recording the show on your podcast, Invest Like a Boss, and can't wait to get into your story.
Man, I'm having too much fun. We can go for a long time, Justin, but I appreciate it. It's been great catching up with you already because we just did a recording on my podcast, like you said, but I just wanted to tip my hat to you because of all the great work that you're doing and the community that you're bringing together and education you're bringing out for investing. This is really important, but also really fun stuff to talk about.
Well, thank you, Sam. And quite frankly, I should be thanking you for all the stuff you're doing because I love in your podcast how you basically are like, hey, you and Johnny, you're like, hey, we don't know. I remember your very first episode. I'm a huge fan of your show. In your very first episode, you're like, well, we don't really know what we're doing, but we're going to just create this podcast and we're going to walk you through what we end up doing. And I just think it's a really cool strategy and way to, one, learn on your part, and two, educate other people who are along for the ride. So you've been doing an awesome, awesome job.
Yeah, I appreciate it. In hindsight, looking back and saying, we're going to start an investing podcast with zero investing experience sounds a little nutty, but I'm certainly glad that we did the venture.
No kidding. Hey, you guys pulled it off and it was awesome. Now, I know that it hasn't always been easy, but before we get to that, I think it'd be really fun to hear about some of your story of when your life wasn't easy, right? Because didn't you go to Florida State?
Yeah.
I think you went to FSU, right? And I remember you saying that you had a bunch of setbacks. We're going to call them setbacks, some minor situations, maybe run-ins with the law.
A few run-ins with the trials with the judicial system of the state of Florida.
So what ended up happening? I'm curious on the story of like, hey, stuff was maybe not going the way that you wanted it to it's going in a much better direction to like, hey, we're crushing it now. So I want to peel the layers back and kind of get into your mind of what's going on.
Yeah, man. I went to Florida State. That was the only school in Florida I got accepted to. Actually, Brian Rabbit, you already mentioned, was a fraternity brother of mine. And I joined a fraternity called Phi Sigma Kappa. And it was a group of basically South Florida kids who were all like fun-loving halfway jocks, like wannabe jocks. But we were basically partiers, like fun guys. Through the fraternity, somehow ended up getting this business spirit to us, right? And you had mentioned, you know, we had talked about your experience in Cutco, and a lot of us in high school were doing Cutco. I mean, there's probably of a fraternity of 70, 80 kids, I would say at least 25, 30 of them had experience in Cutco.
Wow.
So I think we carried a lot of that kind of hustle into college because we were doing Cutco primarily at the end of high school, carried that hustle into college. So we were always we were always in there like scheming on ways to try to make money. And it was sort of the advent of the internet. And so we were looking at this new frontier really. And so we, you know, we had this really, this mixed criteria of like party, sports, try to make money, like this big cycle. And the party side kind of caught up to us a bit, you know, and and I had a few run-ins with the FSU PD. I mean, totally nonviolent crimes. I say that halfway joking, but it was, yeah, I would like go out to bars and there'd be police officers dressed in Abercrombie and Fitch that were like 24 years old and they'd strike up conversations with you. And then 5 minutes later, they pulled a badge and they're asking for your ID. And of course, the only ID I have on me is fake. So I'm like underage drinking, fake ID, go to jail. But that actually happened to me 5 times when I was a freshman. I got arrested 3 times for underage drinking, fake ID, criminal mischief, which was literally just me breaking a window at my dorm and the police coming in and arresting me. So like a bunch of ridiculous arrests, which more or less, not to making excuses, but basically everyone does the same type of activity in college. I just happened to get caught for it. And it really was, the first one was funny because I got arrested literally, Justin, 15 minutes from when my parents hugged me my freshman summer and said, goodbye, son, we love you. We're here to support you. We know you do well. And I waved them off and I turned around and saw a buddy that I knew from like high school. I didn't know I was going to Florida State. And he's like, hey, Sam, you know, come over here. Hey, man, I got some beers. You want a beer? I'm like, yeah, I want a beer. We cracked a beer. And then we like walk outside and there's a police officer standing right there. And, you know, in high school, that would happen at parties and they would just be like, hey, guys, like, you have a safe ride home? You're like, yeah. And they'd be cool. And then college, they're just like, you're getting arrested. So yeah, that was college for me. I ended up with 6 arrests during college. And it was, yeah, it was, I say it laughing now, but my freshman year, by the end of that year, I was like, this is really bad. You know, I was scared to like go. I thought it was so jinxed. I was afraid to go outside and cross the street. I'm like, I'm going to get arrested for doing something like that, you know? So it's really psychologically burdensome on me. But in hindsight, I was able to take that, redirect my energy into really productive things.
No kidding. So, I mean, first of all, I feel like most people are doing what you're doing, like you said, not getting caught. I get someone getting caught, but 6 times? I mean, that is some bad luck, Sam. Goodness gracious.
You know, whoever's pulling my strings up there in the simulations, just like, listen, man, you need to be doing X and you're messing around. So, I'm going to keep you in check quick. This isn't going to be like this 30-year delay. It's going to be like, boom, now you need to reckon.
So you are a world traveler. Yeah, I love traveling. Mm-hmm. I've been to 76 different countries. You, I believe, have been to over 100. Mm-hmm. And this started early on in life because after college, I believe you moved to the UK. Is that right?
That's correct. But it happened actually before that, because after this troublesome freshman year, I was 19 and I was not having a type of college experience that was enjoyable at all. Like I was hiding behind closed doors and all my friends were going out partying and I just wasn't able to participate. And so I got the opportunity to go to Switzerland and I looked up the drinking age and it was 18. So I'm like, wow, happy days.
No arrest.
Arbitrage. So I was able to, instead of buying a car, like all my friends are doing, I was like, I'm going to put that towards studying abroad. So I went over to Switzerland and that actually really opened my eyes to opportunities abroad. Cause I realized even in Switzerland, I was like, wow, they're just backwards, man. Like, why is there not Walmart here? Why is there not all these services? Right. A little bit naive, but it made me enjoy being outside the US so much and see opportunity. And so that's what really, I wouldn't have ever ended up in the UK out of college if I hadn't had that experience of studying abroad.
That's awesome. What a cool experience early on. And so you're in the UK, you graduated. Did you go there because you wanted to go there? Did you go there for an opportunity? Because you started a company, an electric cigarette company prior to, you know, that being a norm. Like today, that's a norm. When you started it, that was not a norm. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. After the arrest, I realized that there was no way I was ever going to get a job. And so I had to figure out how to start a business, and I'll yada yada over this pretty quickly. But my sophomore year, I decided to start a social networking site in college. This was 2003, 2004. So early on in the internet. And that did fairly well. And I was able to do a deal my senior year of college with a guy that basically more or less bought it, but it was sort of like a licensing deal. And that kind of gave me a bit of spirit as an entrepreneur. After that, I did different odd jobs. I mean, I did like the true hustle stuff of like road construction at 5 a.m. in the morning on the side of I-95 to make ends meet. But I was always dabbling in the internet space and trying to figure out how to make money. And that led me into doing affiliate marketing and learning how to market online products really, really effectively in the early days and start making some serious commissions. In fact, our mutual friend, Brian Rabbit, and I was living with him in an apartment downtown West Palm Beach. And I can remember I was making like $100 a day doing affiliate marketing. And all of a sudden, like 2 weeks later, I was making like $5,000 a day. And then like 2 weeks later, I was making like $30,000 a day. And I'm living in this like shared $300 a month apartment. And I'm so superstitious that I'm just like, I'm not leaving my room because I'm refreshing the stats like every 3 seconds, like new sale, new sale, new sale, new sale. And money was just pouring in. And then like once a week, I'd go out and just like let loose and like buy bottles at a club and stuff. And it was so fun. But through that experience, I learned that, okay, I can market certain products really, really effectively online. And when e-cigarettes came out, I was actually out in a conference in Las Vegas. And one of the very first e-cigarettes was ever manufactured, the guy that made it and actually invented the e-cigarette was a guy from China. And he was there with it and he barely spoke any English. And he came and he knew that we were really good at marketing. He's like, hey, here's my product. Can you sell it? And I looked at this thing and I tried it and I thought, well, I'm actually really good at marketing healthcare products. If this thing could be just a little bit better, taste better, and have a better design, man, I bet tobacco smokers would use that. And so that's where the idea of starting like an e-cigarette business came from. And this was before there was really any e-cigarettes on the market. But how I ended up in the UK was because we took a look around online and of the entire world, the best, most established product was in the US and they were still very small. But I said, okay, they have some pretty good trajectory, pretty good momentum. Let's just take the next best market. Why compete here? Take the next best market. At age 24, 25, I said, let's launch this business in the UK. I've never been there. Sounds like an adventure. And that's how it started. I flew to the UK. I had a bunch of product from China shipped over to me, met me in London. And I started a road tour around the UK with product in the back of a hatchback.
Yeah. So first of all, I admire your ability to just leave the comfort of everything you know to start a company that you hope will make it in a market that you've never been to. I mean, that's just incredible. I love it. It's very inspiring. And what's cool about your story is we get to celebrate one that did make it, that went the full cycle. So you're literally like living out of a car, selling product from a car. And 4 years later, you get acquired by one of the largest in the space, what becomes the largest in all of the UK, right?
Yeah, it was an incredible experience. Day one to year four, I mean, it all happened very quick. We never had venture capital, but it literally started out of living in a car, selling and marketing product out of a car, and that full cycle up to living in a hostel, to our first office, to having an actual decent apartment and not living off bread and noodles, to hiring staff. And there were so many complications along the way, but it was just an incredible, incredible ride. And like the second part of that business was actually going to China and starting our own manufacturing facility in China. And that was even a more interesting experience than the Britain experience of just being over in China in 2009, 2010, when like nobody was there and starting that manufacturing. We ended up having 400 employees there and like only one of them spoke English. And yeah, just like the experience of living at the factory and hanging out with these people and like how fast innovation and production happens there is just mind-boggling. But Justin, ever since I got out of that business, I've been on a path of trying to figure out how to replace the thrill of that those 4 years, and I haven't found it yet. So it is kind of fun to talk about it, remember it.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, I'm glad that we can reminisce because the amount of value you were able to create in such a short period of time. I mean, 4 years. I mean, that's incredible. So you sold SkySig to a publicly traded company for $100 million. That's an incredible exit. Over the course of 4 years, you're living so cheaply, right? You're totally like pinching pennies, in some cases unsure early on, like, oh, is this real? Is this affiliate marketing? Am I going to keep getting paychecks? I'm going to keep living in a $300 apartment, to living in a car until you upgrade to the hostel, then upgrade to an apartment, to now having $100 million. I'd love to hear what that was like, that experience.
Well, the negotiation was pretty grueling. The actual sales cycle was pretty grueling. We had two companies that were basically bidding on us, but both of them almost fell out at the last minute. And we were starting to have cash flow issues. And I think maybe just the fact that I had been testing e-cigarettes like nonstop for 4 years, my body was like over nicotined out, for lack of better words. I was pretty burnt out at that point. I was flying back and forth from China to Edinburgh like every 2 weeks, and basically living at factories. And still at that point, I was like living off basically nothing, just investing everything back into the business. But I was 28 when that whole thing happened. So it was sort of surreal. It was an experience I'd never had before, going through any type of sales process that big. You know, I was sitting across the table from the top six executives at Philip Morris, and then the top six executives at Lori Lord, and having to do these pretty hardened negotiations. So it still is surreal to me. I ended up in the hospital for 10 days before closing. I think it was just literally because my body was so like burnt out and stressed out and didn't know how to handle like that type of pressure. Cause it was one of those things that was like, look, we're either going to get this deal done and that type of money is on the table, or we're not. And this whole thing is probably going to fall apart and they're going to eat your lunch. Because there was no investing going into these companies. It was still way too gray. No one knew if tobacco was going to own it, pharmaceutical was going to own it, or governments were just going to shut you down. And I woke up every single day not knowing what that future was going to look like. I woke up every single day thinking, this can end tomorrow. And so I was always trying to get a deal done. And fortunately, we were able to, but I was pretty strong at that age, but that it really took the life out of me. But man, what an incredible experience. The actual deal turned out to be 50% cash up front and 50% earnout. And the earnout was really straightforward. So we thought it was basically a lock, but literally the week after we completed the deal and got the first half in, we ended up in litigation with a superpower, more or less to say. So the earnout basically got frustrated pretty quick, and the relationships between us and the buyer were not smooth from that point forward. So we did okay in the earnout, but we didn't get that full allotment. But needless to say, we still did very good. It was myself and three other partners. For a 28-year-old, it was certainly life-changing money.
No kidding. There's so many things I want to ask you about that experience, because the way that it's like romanticized, having this big exit and what you think it's going to be, what you see in the movies, what you maybe envision from your other friends or see on Facebook, you think it's going to be this unbelievable experience. But then when you actually have it, and I want to know what it's like for you too, but like, you think it's going to be one thing, and then it's kind of like, okay, what's next? Did you have anything like that where it like felt so good, but then at a certain period of time, it's like a few days later, a week later, a month later, it's like, okay, this is, you know, so I got some extra digits in the bank account.
It was almost, I hate to be a spoiler, but it was almost all negative from day one. It really was, it was not good for me, because I was in the hospital building up to that. So I had no energy basically when we signed. I woke up in the hospital. I saw the headline in the news. So I knew the deal was done, because I went to sleep with like the paper signed, but we weren't sure if they were going to back out. And I'm like, I signed, I'm done. Like, I'm going to sleep. I woke up, saw it in the news. And then the next day the money was in the account. So it was like bang, bang. And then for me, Justin, it was like, I had built this thing from the hatchback with product in the car, like over there, just on this wild adventure. And I had this nucleus, the company and the team that we built was like all, I was 24 to 28 during that time. And the entire team was like, you know, 22 to 24. So it was like this, almost like a fraternity that was just going to war every single day, like building this thing. No one had experience. We were just in there, all energy, motivation, and ambition. And it was such a like an incredibly dynamic and ambitious place to go to work every day. Like, I hated the weekends, just wanted to be in the office with everybody. But when we did the deal, part of the deal was like, hey, I'm going to go finish up manufacturing. I'm done. Like 2-3 months, I'm done. And the light switch was on. And when we did the deal, the light switch was off. And like literally that week, it was like, I'm not needed. I was like, how am I not needed? Like, of course I'm needed. No, I'm not needed. And it was this massive void because at the age 28, all of my friends were working. None of them were traveling. Everyone's on the grind trying to get there. And I was just faced with this reality that like my life, I was 100% investing committed. My entire life was this business. I had nothing else going on. I didn't even date girls for 3 years because I just was putting every bit of attention in the business. And then it was over. So, you know, I immediately tried to replace that with angel investing and massive traveling and going out to bars every night and bars in the day, like, whatever I could to keep my mind off like the void. And it was a very, very difficult time for me. Very difficult 18 months. And to some degree, it's like I said, it's been very difficult to replace that, the whole experience, man. So good.
Hey, thank you just for being super vulnerable, Sam, and for your mm-hmm. honesty here on this, because what I want people to understand is that we glamorize this thing that may not need to be glamorized, right? So having a big, massive exit isn't always what people make it out to be. And having an increase in an influx of income, though it sounds great, it comes with another set of problems and issues and things that you need to work through. And I think most people don't realize that the majority of deals when there's an exit happen with some form of earnout. So you hear this big number, it's whatever number, but that's including this future money that hasn't been paid yet, may never get paid, might be tied to certain metrics that you have to hit in order to get paid, might be over 4 years, sometimes even more. And so I like hearing the real deal on this. And then I think it's also just so important to know that for people to know that if you think that a big lump sum of money is the answer to whatever your problems are, it's not. In fact, it can actually be the opposite and make it even worse. And so it's very interesting hearing your journey here. And unfortunately, I've heard this before from a lot of people.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
I wish it was sweeter sometimes. Now, so what I'm curious about is like, when did you pivot to the podcast? How soon after this? Because you've exited, you've had a little bit of maybe unexpected type of circumstances, maybe not exactly what you envisioned for yourself after a big monster exit. When did you kind of get things back on track? When did you start feeling better? When did you start creating passion in your life again? I think the podcast has been huge for you in that regard, at least as an outsider, that's how I feel.
Sure.
And like, how did you use that as like an educational piece for the next chapter of your life and your professional journey as an investor, as opposed to an entrepreneur?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it really was. What I realized was it was all about the journey. All the highs of building the business were in fact building the business. And like you said, the payout at the end, it's almost like a paradox where I was like, I had this expectation that there's going to be a rainbow full of happiness that just got sewed into me and I would never look back. And that wasn't the case. So it really took me for a bit of a spin. But really what happened was during the business, I wasn't making much money, but I was literally living off the business. I had all my housing paid for, all my flights, literally almost all my food, almost everything in my life. So I was spending nothing out of my account. And then when we sold the business, all of a sudden I realized, I'm like, oh, damn, man, my like lifestyle is actually pretty damn expensive. Like when I start paying for everything. And like most people, or at least what I've come to know now that I've been doing the podcast for 5-6 years and been studying investing, is that I didn't know what to do. I was actually scared because I didn't know how to invest. I had zero income. And so what did I do? I asked around who knows a financial advisor, someone knows how to manage money, had a quick introduction. And then I gave 40% of what I had made in the windfall to a financial advisor. Didn't ask any questions, gave them complete discretion over my account. I don't know. You're the expert. You make all the decisions. I don't want to approve things. You do what you think's best. And after, you know, 2 years, and this was kind of part of the down cycle, the music wasn't matching the words because I was looking at the stock market which, you know, I was looking at the Dow Jones, and the Dow Jones was going up, and I'm looking at my account, and the account is kind of volatile and going down and or sideways. And over the course of 2 years, I think the market was up, the Dow Jones was up, say, 20%, and my account was flat. And I was still having to pay these tax bills at the end of each year because there was fixed income in my account. But the most frustrating part was that I would go into these meetings with my financial advisor and nothing made sense to me. I felt like I was being manipulated. I felt like I knew what was going on, but they were saying something different. I was very intimidated by the process of meeting with them in their corner office and their nice suits and these older gentlemen that were speaking all these words that I couldn't understand. And I just thought to myself that this is no way to go through life. I have to feel this vulnerability with my money. And I know I'm paying them something, some type of fee. Yeah, they say they're going to make me 8% and they're going to take 1%. Seems like a good deal, but they weren't making me 8%. And then the book Money Master the Game came out by Tony Robbins. And that really just, it empowered me in a way to think, wow, I can figure this out, right? But investing was still very intimidating and for newbies, right? And especially with more money like that, I was like, I don't want to make a major mistake where I lose 30% of this because I literally may never forgive myself if I do that, right? But at the same time, I'm scrambling, Justin, because I have no income. And I'm like, I need a couple hundred thousand before tax just to pay my expenses and the lifestyle that I want to live. So I thought, look, I know nothing about investing, but there's so many people out there that know nothing about investing. So this is when the best way to do it would be to start a podcast, force myself to learn by putting myself on stage in front of an audience with talented investors and making it look like I know, you know, something like I know what I'm talking about. And that was really the decision to start the podcast.
That's awesome. Well, I'm really glad that you started it. And it's so interesting to hear your story. There's definitely some similarities, some differences for sure, but so many similarities. And I like that you articulated your feelings around these money managers who definitely weren't helping you understand what they were doing. And one of the big issues I have with financial services in general, and by the way, this is not everyone in financial services, but this is the majority of people in financial services and the majority of institutions, maybe all the institutions, that there's so much manipulation and misinformation that what's really happening is not what is promoted to be happening. And there's just overall misalignment. So it's promoted, they'll make you 8% and they make their 1%. But if you make no percent, they still make their 1%. And then you made negative money, right? You had a negative return. And I don't like that. That just does not fit well. But you mentioned something else. And this is an interesting concept as well, because people envision often like, hey, how great would it feel if I had X million dollars? I would be set. But the reality is, if you can't figure out how to protect the principal and invest in things where you have interest coming, cash flow coming, then your principal is going to dwindle down into nothing in time. And so it's like this clock starts ticking. The moment you have an exit, it's like, oh, whoa, I got no income to support my life, like you said, but then your bank account is decreasing. There's like a mental awakening and like hypersensitivity when you see dollars just decreasing, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And you got to like figure out how to put this to work and solve for this problem. And so, and it is, it's an issue, but it creates a lot of stress. And I don't think people see the full picture of what that looks like. And so this is the power of having cash flow and buying assets so that these things don't happen. And I love that you're learning this along the way.
Absolutely. Yep.
So as you are going through this process, you're like, okay, hey, I'm going to start this podcast. I'm not an investor. So I'm going to start an investing podcast. I'm going to learn how to invest. I'm going to bring some people on. I'm going to educate others while educating myself. Totally brilliant. I absolutely love it. What are some of the best lessons that you've learned going from entrepreneur to investor? This could be specific investments. This could be principles. This can be, you know, whatever you want it to be. But like, what are the lessons that you feel like are real good foundational lessons for someone that maybe is transitioning from having a big exit into where you're getting your money to work for you?
Yeah, I guess the same themes keep coming up for us. And if you look at our portfolios, or at least my portfolio, I'm very diversified. And this was kind of one of my drivers, I guess, if you look at what I wanted to do. So I looked at, okay, what's actually my goal? My goal is, what's most people's financial goal? And most places you look would be like, okay, generate enough passive income to be able to support your lifestyle. But I got to that point and I was realized, well, this kind of sucks because now I feel like I'm living paycheck to paycheck, right? And then inflation seems to be actually decreasing my net wealth. So what's better is, yeah, I want to create enough passive income to be able to live my lifestyle while still increasing my net wealth and having a surplus, in fact, to be able to invest in really interesting things, whether lifestyle or investments. And so the second thing was like, I never wanted to lose money because I was spending it down. And I made some mistakes early on. In fact, I think my advisors lost me money on the whole and it just sucked. And I was always that guy going to like casinos and the you know, losing $20 on blackjack was so much worse than like making the feeling of like making 50, right? It was just like, I don't like to lose. So I wanted to make sure I was diversified and like maintain my wealth. And then also I want to have a lot of adventures along the way and have some lottery tickets. Cause I think for me, good investing is often boring investing, but it's such a big part of my life now that I want to make sure I have fun while I'm doing it. But when you think about like the first thing I needed to do was move my money out of the financial advisors, right? And that can be a very intimidating process, but it's actually super easy because most financial advisors are putting you just in a basket of 6 or 7 mutual funds that are literally can be replicated very easily with Vanguard index funds. And so Money Mastery Game helped me do that. But some of the lessons there are like, you know, low fees are absolutely critical. You know, low fees, you don't want advisor fees because those are killer and usually are not productive, like 1%, 1.5%, but also mutual funds. There's a lot of mutual funds that can charge you 1%, 1.5%. But so between an advisor and a mutual fund fee, you can easily have 2 to 3% in fees. Now, if someone's making 8 or 9% a year, they might say, oh, that's whatever, it's fine. But no, that's horrible. Like that over the course of 10 years, that is massive amounts of money. So you want to keep fees absolutely, absolutely low. The second thing is like when it comes to stock equities and stuff, you never want to pick stocks. You always want to be diversified broadly. Very few people can beat the market by picking stocks. Even the best money managers, it's a bad idea. Most people do it, including myself, because I just do it to have fun. But generally speaking, you're much, much better just to be the market. And historically, you're going to be fine if you're just the market. When I say the market, just the S&P 500 or a total stock market index. Another principle is the best portfolio to own. Now you can go crazy with portfolio diversification, the perfect portfolio and the all seasons portfolio. And you know, everyone's got their perfect portfolio and you can have a lot of fun trying to tailor-made a portfolio that you think is going to be, you know, 8% versus 9% or 10% versus 9%. But ultimately, the best portfolio is the one that you can hold. If you're 80% stocks and 20% bonds, or you have gold or inflation protected indexes in there, municipal bonds, or whatever you have, you typically want to be majority stocks. But are you majority US, you majority international, you small cap, large cap, emerging markets? What really matters is sticking to something. And Fidelity did a big research project on this. And they figured that the most successful people, clients of theirs, were actually basically clients that died. And no one had inherited that because that was the fund that no one touched because everyone wants to touch it. Oh, move money here, take money out, pause my account, send me back some money, invest a little more. No, you just want to keep it where it's at and you want to add to it. So there's some really like fundamental things that if you like just get right and you cement these learnings in the beginning, you stick to them and you don't make that major mistake, which is pulling money out in a down market or a bad time. If you can avoid that mistake, your chances to do well over the course of 10, 20, 30 years are very, very good.
Yeah, those are great lessons and great habits. I love that you bring up Money Master the Game. I thought that was an incredible book and very eye-opening. Really to kind of bringing into full circle, into plain sight, what is really happening. And like you, I lost money investing in conventional investment strategies in the stock market with money managers. The big rub I had, rub number one is I lost money, right? Rub number two is that my average rate of return on my statement said that I made money. So it was this huge manipulation of like, well, averaged out, yeah, but actually I lost money. I had a negative return and my statement said that I had an average rate of return that was like 7 or 8%. It was just like the worst feeling in the world. I totally felt lied to and manipulated. And that is an industry-wide issue there. You know, and there, by the way, there are great people that are in that space. I don't want to paint everyone out to be taking advantage of you. There, I've got a lot of friends in that space, but I think that they're the exception and not the rule, unfortunately. One of the things I really admire about you, Sam, is you have been able to live an incredible lifestyle. And you've been able to do that because you're focused on, it's not completely nest egg. You're getting into this space where you're like, hey, let's create some cash flow. Let's get my money working for me. And I think that just even conventional financial education doesn't touch on the fact that we should be focused on cash flow much more than we're focused on net worth, or at least talked about evenly. You know, most people are focused on net worth and they have most of their net worth in either their main company that they own and run that they may not be able to sell because losing the founder, owner, operator of the company, often no one wants to pay for that.
Right.
Or it's like all in the stock market, or maybe someone's, you know, doing more, I would call it risky, aggressive investing in like angel investments. And it's all focused on this net worth, which most people have like net worth that is totally not in reality. So it's like, oh yeah, my net worth is 5 million, 10 million, 1 million, 7, whatever it is, but there's no liquidity. It's all paper money. It's like, in theory, I have this much net worth, but really I don't until this company has an exit, right? Or you don't want to draw upon what's in the public markets because you are worried about not having the return that you could get. So even though it's liquid, it's not really liquid.
That's right.
And so I just think that there needs to be more focus on cash flow and how to cover what it costs you today. And I love that you're doing that in your podcast. I love that you're doing that with your life. I love the adventures you're taking. I get to live vicariously through you with all the cool stuff you're doing. You're in Barcelona right now, which is cool. You're leaving in a week to go somewhere else. Cool. Where else are you going on these adventures? And I'd love to hear some of the lifestyle, because you are a lifestyle investor. You are at a point where you are investing your money and living a life without a job and doing some things that you're passionate about.
Yeah, thanks, Justin. I mean, I appreciate that. I've tried to orient lifestyle and investing to be a pair in that sense. In fact, a lot of the investing I'm doing is, it has a lifestyle perk to it, right? And there's a bit of an adventure to it. So it's not strictly the gain or the cash flow, but it's how can I build a lifestyle around investing and have fun while doing it and have some adventure. There's a book that was written that's called Adventure Capitalist that was extremely inspiring to me, where the gentleman basically took a car and drove around like 80 countries and tried to make like an investment in every single country. And I think, you know, that there's a bit of that spirit in me.
I love that book. Fantastic.
Have you read it?
Yes.
Okay. I forgot the author, actually. I just was to look it up.
I'm drawing a blank on it too, but he's got like that yellow car, right? That he takes around.
Yeah. Yellow Mercedes. Jim Rogers.
Yeah, there it is.
Jim Rogers. Fantastic book. So, you know, I ended up in Asia after the deal, and oh man, there's a lot of stories there. Some of them are just kind of funny. Like I was in Thailand looking for residential property investments, and I ended up at a bar in Phuket and with a property developer that was like 26 years old, half Thai, half Belgian guy. And we're having mojitos, and he all start talking about his development. He was going to be building next door and the plot of land he owned, and here's the rendering. And I ended up just being like, have you sold any yet? He's like, no, I'm going to start selling them in 3 months. I'm like, what if I buy the first one right now? And like, we end up shaking on it, and he brings over a credit card terminal, and I put down like $5,000 on my credit card right there and like work out a sweetheart of deal. And lo and behold, that thing got built on time. My unit was like the best unit, the best deal. And me and this guy are still like fantastic friends today. Now that's just a terrible idea to do. But just the fact that like that worked out, you know, sometimes those type of stories like build lifelong bonds. Mm. But I was truly in a hunt for cash flow as this story develops. And I ended up in Hong Kong, got introduced to a guy that did self-storage. Justin, I know you do a lot of self-storage. And I was walking around Hong Kong, just like seeing these self-storage units. I'm like, holy shit, man, this is like the best business in the world. Hong Kong real estate's insanely expensive. No one's got any space. Everyone lives in a shoebox. Like self-storage seems to be all types of market cycle proof. And I just like basically chased this guy around for like a month. Like, dude, let me do a premise with you. Let's do it. Like, let's do it. Let's go get drinks. Let's talk about it. Let's do it. Finally, he's like, dude, I don't want to expand the business more. I'm trying to like consolidate my life. And he's like, but if you want to really do one, I'll do one. It's hard to make money now. I used to make like 20% year over year, but now it's like more like 7-8%. I'm like, dude, if you can guarantee me 7-8% preferred a year, paid out monthly, I'm in. Let's do it. So we ended up doing one, then we ended up doing two. And like now me and this guy are also like super good friends. And I go to Hong Kong whenever I have the chance. Pre-COVID, I was going like 2 or 3 times a year to meet up. And you know, he's got 60 buildings. And then between he and I, we own like 500 self-storage units. But these type of things that like all materialized quite quickly because I was in such a hunt after the exit. And I have some like some fantastic, I would call these lifestyle investments because they give me an opportunity to visit places that I truly love and see people that I'm very good friends with.
Oh, that is awesome. I just love that story. And I believe you interviewed him on your podcast because I remember hearing some of the story of your storage units in Hong Kong.
Yeah. Yeah. We've had Kevin Che on a couple of times.
Yeah, that's it. That's so cool.
The last episode we recorded was actually we were in Iceland together, just hanging out.
That's right.
And we were looking at Northern Lights as they appeared. And we were talking about how he built like his self-storage empire. It's really cool.
Oh, it's so neat. Well, I got to just give you props again. Your podcast is one of my favorites. I think you guys do a great job. And I really want my audience to know that I just wholeheartedly endorse what you guys are doing. I just think it's incredible. And can you just let our audience know where they can learn more about you and more about Invest Like a Boss?
Yeah. So thanks, Justin. I mean, Invest Like a Boss, it started basically as our personal journey. So I think we chatted about on this episode that when we started, we had zero investing experience. And our goal was just to interview the best people we could get a hold of and to put our money where our mouth is. So typically after every episode, one of us is making an investment into something related to that episode. And then we share the portfolios on our quarterly updates with our listeners. And it's really just a journey. We don't have anything to sell. It's more or less a hobby. You know, Justin and I were talking about this before, how like podcasting is just such an awesome thing to do. I mean, just it educates us as much as the listeners, right? And so it's been a fantastic journey. We've been doing it for 6 years. We've got 200 episodes in the bank. And I hope I'm doing it 5 years from now because it never gets tiring.
Yeah, it's so much fun. I love having a podcast because there's just so much like creative space and things to learn. You just realize how little you really know. That's it. Like you might think you know a lot. Start a podcast and just see what other people know and you will realize how little you actually know. It's just incredible.
That's a good point. Justin, when can we get together? When can I join one of your conferences or masterminds? Because I know you guys are doing really good work, and I've heard from some of the people that are in them that the group and the network is incredible, and I got to get a piece of that.
Oh, we'd love to have you. It's first of all, I'd love to have you meet up sometime when you're in Austin or whenever our paths cross in Europe or wherever you might be. But yeah, we can definitely arrange for you to be part of. In fact, it'd be fun to even have you share some of your major lessons that you've had doing your podcast on the episode. So you could be part of one, you can run one. I think that would be really cool. I think our audience would love it. So you're a fellow lifestyle investor. Our lifestyle investors love to hear from other lifestyle investors. So
likewise.
Yeah. So where should people look you up?
So the easiest way is just Invest Like a Boss. My email is sam@investlikeaboss, but we're pretty active there on social. And other than that, if you want, just tune in, subscribe, hang out. And it's a great community, not necessarily just our podcast, but I think the whole lifestyle investing community that is growing. And there's so many more deals and assets to be considering right now. So the crowd and the community are ever important. So the more that we can bring that together, the more fun we're going to have and the more returns we're going to make.
Oh, I love it. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I feel like I could talk to you for another hour. I mean, I feel like we're just getting started. This has been great. I think we're going to need a little bit more or maybe a lot more of Sam Marks. So thank you so much. And to all of our listeners, those of you watching, I just want to end our episode the way I like to end every episode. And that is this: take some form of action today. Take one step towards moving into a life of financial freedom, a life by design, not by default. What's the one thing you can do today to move one step closer to financial freedom? We'll catch you next week.
This week's sponsor of Invest Like a Boss is Indeed.com. And if you've listened to iLab long enough, you know that Indeed is our longest running sponsor of the show. And we love how easy they make it to hire. Indeed is the hiring platform where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. They have a ton of great features. One of my favorite ones is Indeed's Instant Match. When you utilize Instant Match, as soon as you sponsor a post, you get a short list of quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your job description, and you can invite them to apply right away. No need to wait. Indeed does the hard work for you. So when you use a sponsored job post like the one I'm about to give you in a second, Indeed Instant Match shows you candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your description immediately so you can hire faster. Well, how do you do that, you say? You get started right now because we're going to give you $75 to use towards a sponsored job credit. All you got to do is head over to Indeed.com/iLab. This offer is good only for a limited time. So claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/iLab. That's Indeed.com/ILAB. Terms and conditions apply. Pay per qualified applicant. Not available for all users. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Sam, getting a full picture on your story was actually really interesting because I've had bits and pieces through the podcast, through just talking to you, and this is kind of like all wrapped into one. So it was really interesting to hear. The big thing I got out of it really was that you got a lot out of college and I didn't. So I found that really interesting that your college experience really kind of shaped how you jumped into your career. And I found college to be a massive waste of time for me.
Yeah. But man, I look back at my college and I cringe, like I sweat. Those were not easy years. Yeah. There was a lot of fun mixed involved, but dude, I'm telling you, like first 2 years of college, I think I have PTSD from, like, that was intense shit. I would like hide under the covers thinking I'm so jinxed that like, I literally, if I pick my head up, you know, you'd hear sirens going by like, Dude, they're like, someone reported me for something. I was so paranoid, man. That was an unhealthy spot to be.
So you brought it up in the interview and I have to ask you, how do you get arrested less than an hour into your college career? Your parents, I think, were still within view of you.
Couldn't it have just stopped there, please? And just be a funny story? No, I had to continue. Dude, that was too much, man. I remember going home from that freshman summer and my dad's in the pool. He's like, son, you have something to tell me? Because I got a letter in the mail from FSU PD. And I kind of just shrugged it off. You know, I was like, it's just like, someone saw me, a police officer saw me drinking, dad. It was just like a little written thing. No big deal. And it like was never spoken about again until the following semester when they got another four in the mail. And then it was a big problem.
Yeah. Right.
Oh boy.
So that kind of set you to going abroad. And I feel like, before you went abroad, you were kind of, I guess, what was your plan before you realized like, hey, I want to travel and I want to go abroad and build a business outside of the US? Were you planning on sticking in the US before that?
Oh yeah, man. I mean, I was never planning on building a business. I was a criminology major. I wanted to be in the FBI or DA.
Oh, that ain't happening now. Yeah, that was out day one.
Maybe now I could do it again, like go back with my record and like international travel and
Be like that. Like that. What was that? Catch Me If You Can. You remember that movie where that you could be like the consultant after you had a record?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, hey, I could go to China and get into all the manufacturing facilities and have some loops into the governments and know the scene there and stuff. Yeah. I should be a target for the CIA.
Oh, I mean, you still got some time, Sam. This is a future move, I think, in Sam Mark's part.
Yeah, man. Like going back and you connect the dots, it's like, wow, how things changed out. I mean, I think for the better, but some days I question it. But it's like, yeah, all these kind of things, you could never see them happening to like where I am now. But without those events, without that, like that college stuff happening where it's like, dude, I'm telling you, Derek, if you and I went to college, we'd be doing the exact same stuff. We'd be hanging out at the same bars and you would have gotten out of college with zero arrest. And I would have five doing the exact same things. It's like that's what I say. I feel like someone pulling my strings and was just like, nah, you're off course. Like, we're going to correct you. And like, here's how we're going to correct you.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I don't think you did anything that the average college student hasn't done. It's just, you know, yeah. I guess you got caught a lot of times. I did want to ask you too, in the interview, you've never really super gotten deep into the acquisition part. You know, we've kind of mm-hmm. touched on it, but it sounded like you had two of these major tobacco companies going after you guys at the same time. And I guess mm-hmm. fighting for a bid. Was it like, did you guys really want to sell the company, or was it just too good to resist?
Oh man, I wanted to. This was one of the things I learned during this process is like, in a startup, you're going to have, most people have co-founders, right? Or you have mm-hmm. investors, limited partners or such. People that have a lot of at stake, whether it's their sweat equity or a lot of money involved. And it gets emotional, right? Because you're going to go through years and a bunch of different, not just business events, but you're going to go through personal events that are going to pull you in different directions. So like to keep a business relationship together for, let's say 5+ years is very, it's like very difficult because people are naturally going to go and want different things and grow apart, just like most relationships. And so when it got to this point where there was a lot of money on the table, we thought like we had gotten past the point of like, hey, this is just like going to be a business that we could probably make a little bit of cash on and it's going to like go away. And we realized like, this is actually a business. There are actually going to be buyers for it, which now in hindsight is like, oh yeah, of course. But when we were operating, it was like, no one's going to touch this business, right? It's like,
sure.
We don't even know if it's illegal, to be honest. And when we got to a point where like we have something here, but then you also, the future of the industry is so unknown and so gray. It was like, for me, I was looking at the comparables, like Bluesig had just sold for $130 million. And we were not quite as big as them, but we were the UK equivalent of them. And I was like, man, if we could get 50 or 100, like that's more money than I've ever imagined ever making. And it's more than I can, you know, that I could retire on if I wanted to. I'm in my like late 20s. So for me, looking at the risks ahead and the stress that I had kind of endured for the 3-4 years up to that point, building the business, I was like, dude, I want out. Like if we can get anything close to that, let's get out, because there was also zero. The potential of zero was very real. And it seemed idiotic to not try to exit the business. At the same time, I had partners. We had one investor and, you know, people wanted different things. One guy thought we'd build a $1 billion business and didn't want to exit. And he may have been right. But I think the reality is if we didn't sell there, we would have gone bust.
And so what happened? What happens?
Broke apart.
What happens if there are investors on board that don't want to sell? Is it a majority vote, or how did you guys handle that?
It's different in every single situation. In our situation, we needed five people to vote to sell, which in hindsight was a bad way to set it up. Like you should have a majority or a super majority. In our case, we had five people with votes, and all five people had to agree to sell. So one person could veto the deal.
Oh, wow.
And that's basically kind of what it came down to in the end. It was like, yeah, it wasn't a real healthy situation. There was a lot of internal politics going on, but a couple of the guys ended up saying like, they're going to veto the deal unless they get more. And then I ended up in the hospital, like too stressed out to deal with it. And then I woke, kind of came back to consciousness and I was like, kind of while I was incapacitated, there was an agreement that was like, hey, we'll go ahead and do this deal. Like we've got Sam's power of attorney. And I kind of came back to consciousness and I'm like, hell no, like I'm not taking less. And in the end, we ended up doing the deal, but it was not fun in the end. And like in the end, two of the people, like there's three people that are very good friends still, and two people like no one talks to anymore.
That sucks.
And that's the business. Yeah. Unfortunately. Yeah. Shouldn't get that way, but it does too many times.
Can you kind of go into, I wanted to ask you also, so the way it was structured, I can't remember the term now that you said, but you got one lump sum right at the sale. And then there was some kind of the waiting period to get the rest. And you kind of let us know that it maybe was a little bit less amount of money than you had anticipated. I can't remember the term for that.
Sure. So very common structure of a sale of a company, at least a larger scale company, or let's just say multi-million dollars on up, is some form of earn out. And a lot of times you'll get some cash up front on the deal, and then you'll have it, you know, let's just say half or maybe even more than half as part of the earn out. So what you want as a buyer is you want more, you want everything in the earnout. It's like, hey, Derek, I'm going to buy your new, let's say, call it, pick a business name.
My new podcast called.
Okay. Okay. So your new podcast is worth, let's say, $10 million, right? Now I'm going to come in as a buyer and say, Derek, I want to buy this podcast off you. As a seller, you're going to say, okay, I want $10 million in cash. And as a buyer, I'm going to say, I want to give you zero in cash. I want to give you the $10 million over the course of 5 years, as long as the podcast continues to do well and you're here and you meet all these expectations, et cetera, right? Mm-hmm. And so usually there's agreement somewhere in the middle. Of course, it depends on every deal. Some deals are 100% cash up front. Some are 100% earn out. Some are a mix of financing, all types of things. But let's just say a lot of times in deals I've seen, it's like half of cash up front and half as an earnout. So, okay, Derek, let's make an agreement. I'll give you $5 million cash on closing, and I'll give you $5 million over the course of, if you hit certain targets over the course of 5 years.
Now, was it on contingency that you would still be a part of the business, or at least a consulting role at some point?
Not me, not that specifically. It's based usually on the performance of the business. Like, a lot of times they don't really care who's sticking around. They care how the business performs.
Okay.
Right. They want to make sure the business is still making money to substantiate that valuation and the cash flows, et cetera. So, but a lot of sellers that have been through it will tell you that earnouts are constructed to screw the seller. They're advantageous to the buyer, right?
Sure.
In a lot of cases, there's all different types of loopholes and things that the seller could never have predicted that the buyer's got a plan for, right?
I feel like there's a lot of excuses you could come up with to kind of maybe not meet that full payment.
Yeah. So a lot of people that have been through earnouts, you'll hear like, oh no, I didn't get the full earnout, or got screwed in the earnout. There's a lot of disdain with earnouts. The most current deal I just did, with my co-working business, had an earnout, and that's like not looking that great either. And it's not because I haven't put in the effort to achieve that. It's like, because we haven't been given all the resources that we thought we were going to get in the timeline that we thought we were going to get them. And it's not exactly spelled out in the earnout agreement to that degree. So it gets complicated, but I mean, that's business, right? You try to negotiate the best contract, and there's always a leap of faith when it comes to an earnout. Like, you can't spell out every single detail in a contract usually. So there's always a bit of a leap of faith. And a lot of times the seller loses.
That's very interesting. I'm glad you explained that further. And then kind of fast forwarding to the future, I guess we should talk, because it's really valuable, I think, for right now in the market we're in. If you're listening to this, when this episode comes out, we're just entering a bear market in the economy. And Sam had spoke to the importance of diversifying your portfolio. So essentially you didn't start off doing that after the sale, but since then, I think you're hyper diversified, we could call it. But what made you realize that, you know, you need to take control of your own money and diversify it and spread it around?
Yeah. Well, it got really scary after we sold, right? Cause I was living on the company. When I had the company, I was taking very little salary, but I had a company credit card, and like my whole life was business. Every meal I was going out to was with team or clients or suppliers. All my travel, I mean, it was my housing, both in China, Hong Kong, and in Edinburgh, it was all business, right? So I was just like living basically off the business. I was doing business all day, every day. And then when we sold the company, and I was like, I didn't have that credit card or that balance anymore. All of a sudden I had to start paying for my life again. And it got expensive.
Sam's got bills.
And I had no income, and I had no idea how to take the money that I got paid out and turn that into income. Like, okay, I'm putting in a bank and make, 1% interest. Right, that's not paying the bills. So I gave it to an advisor, and then I was pretty lax in the beginning, but then I started looking at my account like every single day, and the volatility was killing me. And I started reading investing books, but things didn't really make sense initially. And, you know, I talked about it a little bit in the interview, but just, I felt manipulated, and it wasn't that I felt manipulated. I didn't feel knowledgeable enough, and it made me feel really vulnerable. And so it was just a kind of this overreaction to like get that in place. And that was what led me to like my initial discussion with Johnny, which like really perked me up. And then he had me on his podcast. I'm like, Dan, this was fun. It might also be a way to learn all the shit that we really need to learn like quick. Or I felt like I need to learn all this stuff in like 5 months. Cause I got to start making money, and I need to do it smart. And I don't want to feel vulnerable with a money manager. So I got to get rid of the money manager. I got to learn to invest. I've never invested more than like $20,000. Now I got to learn how to invest like eight figures. And it's really scary, but I don't want to use a money manager. It's like, how do we do this? How do we do this? You know, and then, you know, and then we kicked off the podcast.
I can't imagine how frustrating it is to know that you have the ability to make multi-millions of dollars, and then you're like, I don't understand how to invest this and grow this, but I'm smart enough to make all this money, but I don't have the skills to keep it. That's got to be really frustrating.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And a lot of people will say it's easier to make it than to keep it, which is insane when people start thinking, oh, so-and-so's got X amount of millions of dollars. Like, surely it's easy enough to keep it. It's like, no, it's not like actually that easy. Like, I think more people blow it or lose it than stay disciplined with it. Right. And even if you stay disciplined with it, you can still fuck it up. Right.
It's gotta be so easy to go.
Look at your metaverse portfolio or crypto portfolio. Wow. You might have been a disciplined metaverse crypto investor, but you fucked it up.
Well, I'm still buying it as it goes down, but we'll see how that works out in the future. Yeah. But it's too. Like,
I just bought more Matterport in Roblox today.
I'm my God. Wow. We're on the same level, Sam. Yeah. I'm following Sam's moves.
Don't.
I thought they used to work out, but not anymore.
Let me take the pain for you.
But yeah, also,
this like, investing year is going to be a funny one. We're going to look back and be like, crypto, metaverse, and drank all the profits, all the wine. Like, what do we got left to show?
That's what keeps it interesting, though, Sam. So,
yeah.
So, and also, like, one other thing like that, when you get to that level where, let's say, you have $1 million in the bank and you see the new Ferrari and you're like, that's pretty awesome. I could afford that. You know, it's got to be hard to resist, you know, nice things that you're like, I deserve this. And, you know, on paper, you can afford it, but maybe a year from now, you can't afford that. So I think that's really tough, too.
You know, what's actually really helped me in that department is being two things. One is being a nomad. Mm-hmm. And two is being out of the US. Because even in like Barcelona, I don't feel the need to have nice things. I have a nice house, but like, I don't want a nice car. This thing's going to get wrecked, you know?
Yeah.
And people aren't driving around in Ferraris. And like Chiang Mai, if you like even have a nice scooter, you look like a douchebag. You know? It's like, if you wear nice clothes, you look out of place. But when I go back to the States, I'm like, man, if I ever end up spending significant time here, like it's you almost feel like obligated to spend to your wealth level.
Certain cities, it's hard too. Like, you know, New York, Miami, San Francisco, and here in LA, it's just like, I know that it doesn't make any sense that over half the people drive a Mercedes, a BMW, or an Audi. It just it doesn't add up that these people can afford this. So you find out they're all leasing it. You know, they got deep credit card debt, and they're showing things on Instagram that they never even bought. You know, they're at the store, but they won't tell you that they're at the Rolex store. They just never bought it. They put it on their wrist and took a picture. Yeah. It's all about, you know, creating this lifestyle that doesn't really exist, or it's just holding on by the thinnest string of your next payment.
Yeah. 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 Well, and I learned a lot from James Altucher as well. Cause he, when he made a bunch of money, off one of his sales, I think he actually wrote a blog article. It's like he made $15 million and then lost it. And we actually interviewed him on this podcast about that. Right. Cause I remember reading that and it was so impressionable on me. And he's like, basically, if you have an exit, do nothing for I think it was like a year. He's like, dude, just do nothing for a year, right? Because he did it, and then he bought a place in San Francisco right before the tech boom, and he bought all these tech stocks. He like basically lost everything he made in the sale. And I was 28 when we sold the company. That's the age where like, man, if you came into that type of money, how do you not go out and buy the Ferrari and start just blowing it in like Las Vegas and doing like all this crazy shit? Like, I don't know. Maybe I'm just not really that drawn to that type of stuff anyways, but I think I kind of avoided a big one by just being outside of the US and not feeling like I needed to play that game.
Yeah, I think you're right. If you guys want to go back and check out that James Altucher episode too, it's episode 56 of this podcast. We'll put a link to that as well. And we'll also add a link to Justin's podcast. He's got some really cool guests on there. Obviously, Sam being one of them. We'll link to his original episode too. And anything else before we get out of here, Sam? I like getting these kind of in-depth little tidbits about you because we always learn something new.
We met each other through this podcast. So that was probably the first time you heard a little bit of that background as well. And I have to say, it's pretty fun to go back and listen to it because those were awesome years. And that story, man, I couldn't trade that experience for anything in the world.
Yeah, I think it's super awesome. And it's interesting too that, you know, we're what, 10 years later now or so? And look how much life changes. Like we're still figuring stuff out and you got different priorities. You're living all over the place. You got properties. Just picture your life 10 years ago to now. Everyone's got that, but it's just like, you don't know what the future is going to hold. So it's like an evolving story. So
can I go back pre-COVID, existential crisis?
You want to go back to living in the factory, sleeping on the floor of the factory?
I'll trade half my money. I promise.
I can arrange you a trip to China, Sam, if you're going to send half your account over.
Derek, mastermind coming up, right?
Yeah. We actually had to change the date, so I can't give it out right now. We're going to do it in June. But if you guys are a Patreon, just sign up at investlikeaboss.com. Click on become a Patreon. Starts at $5 a month. We're going to let everybody in this time because, you know, we've been doing some changes on the show. We got some announcements and we're overdue for a mastermind anyways. And the market's going crazy. So we got to have a chat.
This is going to be a good mastermind. Yeah. So we want to hear everyone's feedback on some of these new episode formats, but also this is the first mastermind we're going to do where, dude, there's a lot to talk about in the markets and investing portfolios, not just all winners this time. We got some major stinkers.
Major. And we'll cover those in the mastermind.
Bring your favorite booze to that mastermind group. And anxiety pills.
But overall, I hope you are too, Sam, but I'm doing okay. But just because I am so diversified, but just seeing those losers is like painful. But overall, I think I'm actually still up on this year. Barely.
Well, let's chat about it in the mastermind. Yeah, that's a tough one for me because the crypto and the metaverse, like there's a lot of meat there. But the diversification, I mean, it's like great, man. When I look in my Vanguard account, it's like dropping the bucket. Like there's not much of a dent, you know? That's why I love that stuff. But I look in my E-Trade account, mostly stocks. Woo, boy. That is not a fun place to hang out.
One dashboard. More thing.
There's no way you can paint that dashboard pretty.
I know, right? It's sad, but it's going to come back. I believe in it. Let's talk about reviews too, because this really helps the podcast. It's like we don't get a review for a while and then we tell you guys review and you do it. So we appreciate it. Spotify has reviews now. I heard Spotify has got more podcast listeners than Apple Podcasts, which is crazy. You can't actually write a review on there, but you can leave a rating. So a 5-star rating really helps. So far, we're still at a perfect 5.0. So thank you, bosses, for that. Let's add to those. And on Apple, just got a recent review. Let's hear from Okidoki35 says, they found out about the podcast through Johnny coming out of Ukraine on YouTube. So there you go. After watching a few videos, realized that he's a fellow Californian and digital nomad. I came across the podcast and was hooked right away with the numerous topics presented on iLab. I enjoy listening to them because the three guys, Sam, Johnny, and Derek, all found their own ways to success, and they're respectful of one another about it. They don't get pushy on their podcasts, and they ask great questions to their guests. I really enjoy the quarterly updates and the recent episode with Trevor Wright on credit card points hacking. I have gotten more people talking about this credit card points hacking and travel than I think any episode in recent memory. So I really like that you guys are into that. And we found out too, from talking to you guys, that you want to hear more about our travels and kind of life experiences. So we're trying to bring that more into the podcast as well.
Yeah, that was an awesome episode on the credit cards. I just listened to that recently. Pretty intriguing. Damn, it's just another thing I don't need to be doing, but
I know. I just got my Amex point offer. No. So I got to figure out how to spend that. And I still don't understand like how to transfer it to airlines. I might have to get on a call with Trevor.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Oh, I'll probably end up doing it as well. More to talk about on the Mastermind.
Yeah. Talk to you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to the Best Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.